In this program, Joseph begins with a personal reflection on the roots of his own interest in mythology, and goes on to offer his insights into the essence of Eastern philosophy as it has come to the West. He also discusses the spirituality of primitive cultures and the gifts they offer modern society, the nature of the vision quest, facing the demons of our self-imposed limitations, the problems of remaining active in life while also being compassionate and turning the other cheek, plus much more. This conversation took place in October 1980, when Joseph was 76. We began with a question about Joseph's early childhood introduction to the world of myth. Joseph, beyond the Buffalo Bill's Wild West show and the Totem Room at the Museum of Natural History, how did you really become, beyond that, become interested in mythology and the study of mythology? What happened?
Well, I think I would have to put it back to having been brought up a Roman Catholic and taking it very, very seriously as a boy, and realizing as I was reading the American Indian myths that the same forms were appearing there in a totally different culture context. And very early, I became interested in this comparative realization. And then in my university years, I was specializing in literature of the Middle Ages. And there, the Arthurian traditions, and back of that, of course, the classical mythologies. These brought forth the same images again in a context that was that of the Christian tradition and yet inflected toward the more universal point of view that is that of the comparative approach. So this was it.
Much of your work is focused on the East, the Orient, and Oriental philosophies and the spiritual traditions of
Yes.
the Orient. How did you first become interested in that area?
Well, that happened when I was a student in Europe. Actually, I met on a steamer back, I think it was 1924, Jiddu Krishnamurti and Roger Gopal, his friend, and his brother Nityananda, who died the next year. And that was my first encounter with the Orient at all. And a young woman who was on the boat was associated with them, and she gave me a copy of Edwin Arnold's Light of Asia, which is the life of the Buddha, which was the first I ever heard of all this. And then when I went to Europe as a student, I started, after a year in Paris, discovering modern art as well as doing my research in medieval material. In Germany, I started Sanskrit and just became fascinated, that's all. And later then, long years later, after I had been teaching and writing, I met Heinrich Zimmer, who was a major Indologist. And at the time of his death, his widow asked me to edit his American lectures, and I went way deep into the Orient. I also was helping Swami Nityananda edit the translate out of Bengali the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, and I knew Kumar Swami and his work, and it was a big load, and it all just opened this material out into vast, vast reaches.
Just brings to mind the influx of particularly of Eastern religions into the United States and Western culture. And this started to occur in the 50s with the influx of Zen Buddhism and then continued with other Eastern traditions coming here in the 60s and 70s. What do you think that presages? What do you think is coming as a result of that?
You must remember that when we're having teachers coming from the East, we're getting the best. There are also crude folk traditions in the East. That's not what we're getting. But the crude folk traditions in the West, that's what we've got. And our best teachers are not the ones that are most listened to. Let's put it that way to start. Now, the best teaching from the East is this one of the Dalai Lama. We had it from Sri Ramakrishna. We have it all over the place from the East, namely that there is a common consciousness, which is our own ground. And so in consciousness, we are one. Insofar as you identify yourself with the consciousness that moves and lives in your body, you've identified with that which you share with me. On the other hand, if you get a fix on yourself and then your tradition, we've got it. then you've removed yourself from the rest of mankind. Now, what the Eastern teachers are telling us is the important thing is not what happened 500, 1,000, 2,000, or 2,500 years ago. Let's say when the Buddha was born and taught, or when Jesus was crucified. What is important is what's happening in you now. And what is important is not your membership in a religious community. What's important is what that membership is doing to your psyche. And it's within you that the divine lives. Our religions, our Western religions, tend to put the divine outside of the earthly world, in God, in heaven. But the whole sense of the Oriental is the kingdom of heaven is within you. Who's in heaven? God is. Where's God? He's within you. And what is God? God is a personification of that world creative energy and mystery, do you see, which is beyond thinking and beyond naming. We think our God has not only been named and known, but he's given us a whole system of rules. Their view is quite different from that. This system of rules are not from God, they're from man. And they're man's clues to how to get to the realization of God. It's a quite different orientation. And it's one when you hear it, you say, ah, yes. Now, the wasteland might be said to be taking of these things literally, concretely, and the rejuvenation of the Arthurian Grail hero, that of recognizing these as of the dynamic of your own interior. Because we're all from a mysterious, trans-rational ground. The subatomic particles tell us that. We don't know what in heaven's name they are, and that's what we are. And then our mind is in this world of time-space relationships, and the mind must open to the impulse and statements of that primary precedent of the general consciousness.
You're mentioning the folk traditions reminded me of in looking at some of these older cultures that have been around for centuries and early cultures. One of the major differences between some of these ancient cultures and our own is that the people really had a balance between being in touch with their deeper side, their innermost selves, and life on the pragmatic level. And we can look at the prehistoric caves they found in France and Spain, I believe, where they have shamanic drawings on the walls of these caves, and indicating that these people very much had a religious base, had a perception of the spiritual side of life. And somehow in our culture, we have to retreat from life to find it. We have to take a vacation, or we have to go off somewhere where it's not a part of our life. And we see that permeating our entire society, where somehow the spiritual is over here in a compartment, and on Sundays we get in touch with that, and it's not really a part of the rational or the pragmatic side of life. How about that?
Well, in the first place, until the 19th century and the rapid progress of the industrial transformation of the world, the conditions of life lasted a little while. You know, for generations, they were essentially the same. So that the manner of dealing with them and getting the spiritual sense of one's relationship to these activities could be developed and richly experienced. However, even in my lifetime, the conditions of life have changed so rapidly that just by the time you get yourself related to one set, another comes along. And I think part of the anxiety of our time is just the result of the rapidity with which change has taken place, and one cannot get a spiritual relationship to this rapidly changing practical problem. That's the how about it of this thing. Now, another important point that the Oriental traditions bring to us is you don't separate your practical life and your religious exercises. Religion isn't for Sunday or for Friday night. You see what I mean? It is for all the life of the whole day. For instance, we're in a religious exercise right now, you and I, Michael. Do you see what I mean? In our relationship, what is it that's playing in? It's through the life that one is to experience the Spirit, communicate the Spirit, and live in it. That's beautiful. And the whole thing of Zen Buddhism, you know, when someone says to the master, what is the Buddha? And he says, have you had your breakfast? Yes. Did you wash the dishes? Yes. All right. Another thing they say is if you see the Buddha coming down the road, run away. Because if you concretize the divine in any fixed image and say, there it is, you're off.
We're really talking about the great mystery, the ineffable.
That's what we're talking about. Yeah. It's exciting to talk about it.
Yeah. It just occurs to me that so often we relate to these other cultures as, quote, primitive. We have this word, primitive. And we see ourselves as civilized and advanced civilization. And yet we've lost so much of what was present in some of those primitive cultures. Namely, that ritual that existed through life that put people in touch with the ultimate.
Well, the word primitive properly just refers to the complexity of the mechanics by which people live. And they are primitive in that sense. I mean, just compare the way I got here by airplane with the way I would have had to get here in a really primitive time. I'd have had to walk from New York before even the horse was mastered. And that's a condition of very, very primitive people. But when you think of their spiritual life, just read any of the American Indian materials. These people lived in a divinely alive world. The man with the calumet about to smoke would point the stem first to the sun so that the sun could smoke. Then he addresses it to the four directions. And in praise of the divinity that's there, he participates in it himself. That is, the whole life is utterly religious. Crude, as it may be, in contrast to ours in terms of the mechanics of life. But ours, I would say, in terms of the spirituality of life, is the crude, primitive one, because we've lost the way to link it.